Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Tell us what you think of it by leaving us a review on iTunes or by letting us know on Twitter or Facebook.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And now, a few words from the general.
Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war. Because the very thought of losing is hateful to America.
Real World War II General George Patton, played by actor George C. Scott, probably never said those precise words, although he is immortalized in that film portrayal in the 1970 Oscar-winning film that bears his name. This hour, The Generals, Reality, and the Quest for Hollywood Oscars. We'll look at some of the real stories behind this year's nominated films. A lot are based on real historical events. From real people come the best pictures. It's a series we're running this week. We'd love to know if there is a potential Oscar-winning real story in your own life. Tell it to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org for all the information. Also, important developments in Ukraine and Uganda later this hour, but we begin with the generals and their view of the troops they need right now. In 2014, who needs a standing army and why?
We are repositioning to focus on the strategic challenges and opportunities that will define our future. New technologies, new centers of power, and a world that is growing more volatile, more unpredictable, and in some instances, more threatening to the United States.
It sounds like Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel is trying to alarm us, and yet he's proposing to shrink the U.S. combat-ready soldier force to about 450,000, down from over 500,000. Russia has an army of well over 1 million. China has 2.3 million men-at-arms. But these numbers apparently have little to do with the actual military needs of these countries and much more to do with domestic politics. In the case of the United States, shrinking the Pentagon to match strategic military realities has been a challenge for decades. Joining us to try and understand where Defense Secretary Hagel may be headed is Andrew Bacevich, retired colonel who is now a professor of international relations at Boston University. His latest book is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Andrew, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much.
So a couple of very basic questions. Who needs a standing army in the year 2014 and why? And is the U.S. one of them?
Well, yes, we need a standing army, although in some senses, the question is off point. Armies don't fight alone. As they did, for example, in the days of Napoleon or the days of Grant and Lee. Armies fight as part of a larger conglomeration. We really need to think of land power, air power, sea power, cyber power, functioning as kind of an integrated entity. And I think the point Americans need to appreciate today is that the role of land power in that team is likely, no guarantees, is likely to diminish in the decade or a couple of decades to come. And that's why our army is shrinking.
So how do we compare the numbers, 450,000 that Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel is looking for, with the more than 500,000 soldiers ready to go today? With this World War II marker, which is being played in the media, how important is the sort of World War II troop-level marker in terms of our strategy with the land power today?
I think it's utterly irrelevant. I mean, among other things, if we end up with an army of, let's say, 450,000 after this next drawdown occurs, that army of 450,000 will actually be vastly more capable than the army of several million that we had back in World War II. So we don't need a huge army. We do need a capable army. But the question of what the heck we want an army to do is the one I think that requires a great deal of thought at the present moment. The fact of the matter is we're not going to invade China. We're not going to invade Russia. There does seem to be an increasing need. I'm not sure if it makes sense strategically, but an increasing reliance on smaller scale special operations forces that kind of go in, do things quickly and get out, some of those forces will be army forces, but the numbers involved are not necessarily big numbers.
So so much to talk about here. How then are we to evaluate the Chinese People's Liberation Army, the PLA, with a standing army of 2.3 million? Is that some kind of economic stimulus program in China? Is that a political number? Is that something that is actually strategically important to China and its neighbors, 2.3 million men-at-arms?
First of all, it's true that People's Liberation Army is also becoming smaller gradually over time. I think it's also true that the People's Liberation Army has in some senses been, its function has been as much domestic as international. It's been one of the pillars of the Chinese Communist Party and a vehicle that enables the party to maintain control. But let's imagine, and it's not unimaginable, let's imagine that there would be another war between Vietnam and China, two nations that don't have the friendliest history. Let's imagine that the Chinese army invades Vietnam. Should the United States choose to involve itself in such a war, I would hope they wouldn't, it's not going to be, the role we would play would not be to send a 500,000 soldiers to Vietnam as we did back in the 1960s. So again, we only have a certain amount of money that we're willing to invest in defense. Quite frankly, we already spend more than we probably ought to. So the question is, how do you distribute those dollars in order to acquire the mix of capabilities most likely to be relevant in a future conflict? And at the present moment in history, it does appear to make sense to give fewer dollars to the Army and more dollars to the Navy and to the Air Force.
All right. Since I've been covering Pentagon stories going back to the base closing days of the 1980s, it always has appeared that troop numbers and specific procurement programs and numbers of troops has been something of a CAT scan of the American Congress. It's much more about what resides in each individual congressional district and less about overall strategy. What's the chance that Hegel is going to be able to get any diminishment through Congress, which is protecting its turf in each one of those districts where the Pentagon has a role?
Well, I mean, I think the history would say if he's lucky, he'll get half a loaf. But again, I think your question is a very good one. Here is the military-industrial congressional complex in action. And anything that is likely to affect jobs back in the congressman's home district, whether it's jobs because of a base that somebody wants to close or jobs because of a weapon system that somebody wants to close down the production plant, is going to be very substantial resistance. And it doesn't matter whether the individual member is a Republican or a Democrat or is perceived to be, a defense hawk or is perceived to be a dove. They're going to protect what seems to provide an immediate benefit to their constituents.
Andrew Bacevich, retired colonel, now a professor of international relations at Boston University. His latest book is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
And now for those Americans without military experience, the closest you may have come to joining an organization with its own special code, with funny clothes that you wear, medals and symbolic patches, an organization known for working really hard but partying even harder. The closest you may have come to that is joining a college fraternity or sorority. Toga party, anyone?
The issue here is not whether we broke a few rules or took a few liberties with our female party guests. We did. But you can't hold a whole fraternity responsible for the behavior of a few sick, perverted individuals. For if you do, then shouldn't we blame the whole fraternity system? And if the whole fraternity system is guilty, then isn't this an indictment of our educational institutions in general?
Fraternity culture pilloried back in the 1978 film Animal House. And many of you have been telling us some stories of your campus days from Hendersonville, North Carolina. We did horrible things like swallowing live mice. Oh, those were the days. But the odd combination of entitlement and rebellion embodied in the college fraternity goes way back. A It's the Phi Delta Theta fight song. That group dates from the 1840s, Miami University of Ohio. And the first fraternities go back to the founding days of America itself, a place for training people to be independent and to be leaders. Oh, and to live in much better housing than the college dorms provided. 44% of U.S. presidents have held fraternity memberships. 76% of all congressmen and senators belong to a fraternity or sorority. And since 1910, 85% of the Supreme Court justices have been fraternity or sorority members. Joining us now is Mick Wilson, executive director of the national organization of the Kappa Sigma Fraternity. Mick, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show.
What is this history and purpose of fraternity life as you see it in the 21st century, Mick?
Well, I believe that members of college fraternities join college fraternities because they identify with a group of people who have similar values, who have similar principles, and who come together for a common purpose.
And is that why you joined?
Yes, it is. The things that I took away from the fraternity helped me prepare for life. It helped me prepare for a career. It helped me seek a master's degree. It helped me become a husband and a father and a leader in my community.
Finally, when I was going to college, fraternities were associated with kind of the conformist, dorks of the world. And that was a period we were going through in the 70s and 80s on some level. Do you think today that fraternities are on the rise and that experience that you're talking about is much more generalized to people on campuses today?
Well, I'll say this. Since 1980, when I first joined the Kappa Sigma staff, we have doubled in size. And that tells me that now that there is more interest and more need for college fraternities than at any time in our history. In Kappa Sigma, we've identified four values upon which we establish our operations and work with our undergraduates. And those four values are fellowship, leadership, scholarship, and service. And by espousing those values, practicing them on a day-to-day basis, we realize that we're preparing our young people for a future career, to be leaders in their communities, and to be good citizens.
Mick Wilson, executive director of the National Organization of the Kappa Sigma Fraternity. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later this hour, how some insurance companies view the balance of leadership training and wild behavior in modern fraternities. Bad apples are costing fraternities and families affiliated with them a lot, it turns out. Here's a story from New York City. Dangerous behavior was part of the definition of fraternity life, and because the fraternity members were usually the cream of campus society, those that could hold them responsible most often looked the other way.
My name is John Winans, and I attended the University of Washington in the 1970s, and I was a member of a fraternity there. Really, it was all good fun. We probably drank a little more than we should have, but it wasn't the binge drinking that you see nowadays. It was a good, congenial way to have a lot of guys with similar attitudes and experiences around you, a lot of good friends.
Share your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
And now a political revolution in Ukraine that may come down to some cold hard cash.
We look to the new government to create the conditions for such change in a spirit of reconciliation while ensuring accountability for human rights violations. For our part, the international community must work with the new government.
That's British Foreign Secretary William Hague on the pressing need to offer financial help to the people of Ukraine to avoid an imminent default and to keep the revolution moving without the political turmoil we've seen over the past few weeks. The U.S. and Britain have pledged support, but what does it all mean? Liz Alderman is Chief European Business Correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome, Liz.
Hello.
And also with us is Lubomir Mitov, who's chief economist for the Emerging Europe Department at the Institute for International Finance. Lubomir, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you. It seems to me that the West needs to write a check for $15 billion today if they're going to compensate the Ukrainians for what they appear to have lost in the freezing of $15 billion that Vladimir Putin promised the Ukrainians some months ago. What's going on with that, Lubomir?
Well, it's true. Russia promised $15 billion to Ukraine, but they didn't promise to give the money at once. What Ukraine really needs now is some cash, $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion, just to stabilize the situation in a country which is under enormous financial pressure. State coffers are empty. Foreign exchange reserves are dwindling very fast. We have seen signs of bank runs. And the only way, given the current situation in Ukraine, the political uncertainty, would be to provide some cash now up front. And actually, the good thing today is that the European Union apparently has pledged these awards of the Commissioner for Budget and Financing to provide 1 billion euros as soon as in March in something like a down payment.
Well, let's get a view from Liz Alderman now. So Liz Alderman from The New York Times, is that how the EU views this, as just a simple payment of a billion? Or does the EU view this as really having to fill the vacuum of a possible Russian departure from Ukraine? And does this end up turning out to be something like another Greece?
Well, the EU, as well as the United States, view this as basically, you know, any short-term payment they could make, as well as any longer-term financing that they're looking at, is really, you know, aimed at, you know, trying to ensure that the Ukraine that we see today is stabilized, if it's going to possibly, or at least part of it, move towards really being a greater partner with the European Union. That's what the schism that we have seen in the last couple of weeks has really been about. And as Lubomir, you know, indicated, over time, Ukraine is going to need much, much more than, you know, $1 billion or even $15 billion. Over the next couple of years, we're talking about maybe $35 billion is a number that's been bandied about. What happens will depend also a great deal on whether the International Monetary Fund winds up being a part of this. As you may recall, the IMF had actually demanded very tough reforms previously, which is one reason why the now departed president, Mr. Yanukovych, had actually wound up reneging on the planned association agreement. If the IMF comes riding to the rescue, they are certainly going to demand stiff austerity terms, as well as cleaning up the corruption that has plagued the economy, and they weren't able to do it before. Whether they can do it now remains to be seen.
Liz, does Ukraine even have the option to go to the credit markets to issue debt, bond, that sort of thing, or are they in a completely different category?
Well, right now, they are effectively shut out of borrowing from international markets like Greece was and like some other troubled Eurozone countries were. The country's been downgraded to a near default level by most of the major ratings agencies within the last several days. So really, they are going to be completely dependent on, you know, whatever aid can come through, particularly from the Western partners.
Lubomir Mitov, this $35 billion number that's being bandied about that Liz mentioned a moment ago, who's going to pay that, and how quickly does that have to be infused into the Ukrainian economy to keep something, you know, fairly catastrophic from happening?
Well, let me first say that what is $35 billion, $25 or $30, we really don't know. But the money is very, very substantial, definitely north of $20 and $25 billion. The only plausible solution to us is the IMF. And there are two reasons for this. First, the IMF is the organization which has the money, can provide most of this $25 or $30, $35 billion. But more importantly, is the IMF has the capacity and the experience of implementing reforms. Everybody here speaks about money. But actually, the issue is about the reforms. Ukraine cannot continue as it used to for the last few years. Adjustment is absolutely necessary, imminent. The only question here is how you do it. Do it orderly, with support from the international financial institutions, or it happens through a collapse. So the IMF would really require, and that's very important, would require very tough measures. There'll be austerity, there'll be exchange rate adjustment. There'll be cleaning up balance sheet of the banks. This is a process which will take not only 1 year, probably 1 year, probably 2 years, but the only plausible source of money for Ukraine over this year and probably next year is the IMF. Some money could come from the World Bank, some money could come from the European Union, but the bulk of the money, the implementation, the supervision of the program has to come from the IMF.
Lubomir Mitov is chief economist for the Emerging Europe Department at the Institute of International Finance. Liz, quickly before we go, any way this can happen without cooperation with Russia?
That remains to be seen. I think that's the million-dollar question.
Billion-dollar question, indeed. Liz Alderman, Chief European Business Correspondent for our partner, The New York Times.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
So did you catch this remark earlier this hour?
Here is the military-industrial congressional complex in action. And anything that is likely to affect jobs back in the congressman's home district, whether it's jobs because of a base that somebody wants to close or jobs because of a weapon system that somebody wants to close down the production plant, is going to be very substantial resistance.
That's writer, professor, and retired Colonel Andrew Basevich's assessment of Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel's likelihood to get his troop reduction plans announced yesterday through Congress. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us now. Hey there, Todd.
Hey, John.
So Hagel's going to face a very familiar, very long-standing headwind in Congress to try to get this shrinkage through. Is he helped by sequester, anything else that's going on the Hill?
Oh, I'm glad you asked about sequester, and I'm glad you played that clip because this is going to shape up to be a case study 101 in Washington congressional budgetary smoke and mirrors. John, you mentioned sequestration. Let's start there. Hey, Chuck Hagel got tons of headlines yesterday and this morning and today on The Takeaway because he wants to reduce troop levels down to 440,000. That's small. That's the smallest level since World War II. Current law, which is sequestration, already has troop levels dropping down to 420,000. Chuck Hagel's getting all kinds of headlines for saying, I'm going to push Congress to cut the military. Actually, he's pushing for a 20,000 troop increase when you consider current law.
I love that. Yeah.
When you consider current law. Now, everyone in Congress, of course, as we know, is fighting to plug sequestration. This came out of the budget fights of a year and a half ago, those automatic spending cuts that affect everything from Head Start and domestic programs to the Pentagon. And people who have military bases in their districts and manufacturing, all the rest of it, run around to plug sequestration. And they may pour some more money to plug that in future years. That's possible. But under current law, 420,000 is the projected number. In fact, it's the number that's in the defense authorization bill under sequestration. So let's start there.
All right, well,
actually getting an increase.
So then the people who are criticizing Hagel, are they for sequestration or are they taking a national security stance and actually want the troop levels to be higher than 440,000?
Everybody wants them higher and nobody is for sequestration. Sequestration was never supposed to happen and it did because Congress is so dysfunctional. Add on another part of congressional smoke and mirrors, keeping in mind, of course, that Chuck Hagel doesn't control the budget. Congress does. One of the things that Chuck Hagel says he's going to cut is an airplane called the A-10 tank killer, the Thunderbolt. This isn't the first time the Pentagon has told Congress, we don't want this plane anymore. We want to cut it. There was a big fight over this already in 2013, and we know how that went. Congress said no thanks. The Thunderbolt, the A-10, is stationed in Air Force bases from Louisiana to Missouri to Montana and Arizona, and that's just where it's based. Forget about the dozens of states where the parts are manufactured. That means jobs, just like our guy said this morning. And Congress so far, John, has shown no interest in cutting the A-10.
Basevich said to us earlier this morning that the reason the A-10 is being cut is because it's going to be replaced by the F-35. Does that have the same popular support on Capitol Hill?
The F-35 has a lot of popular support. It also is manufactured, its parts and its service in states all across the country. That means everybody gets buy-in for the jobs and the money that pours in from the Pentagon budget and the contracts. But all I can tell you is what we know from the past, which is that this isn't the first time the Pentagon has said, let's get rid of the A-10. And it's not the first time Congress has said, no, we're going to keep it even if you don't want it.
If you want to revisit this, I got two words for you. Base closings. That whole controversy took decades.
It's
still going on. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and here are some quotes from an official bill signing in Uganda earlier this week. Arrogant and careless Western groups have tried to recruit Ugandan children into homosexuality, or gays should rehabilitate themselves and society should assist them to do so, or we have been disappointed for a long time by the conduct of the West. There is now an attempt at social imperialism. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni said this and a lot more as he signed into law a bill authorizing criminal punishments for homosexual acts up to life in prison. Social imperialism. Is this a new wave of anti-Western sentiment in Africa? And are gays caught in the middle? Joining us is Jindai Fraser, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, currently Distinguished Public Service Professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Assistant Secretary, welcome.
Thank you very much, John.
So as a professor, you look at this Museveni decision and what's going on in Uganda as a complication of U.S.-Ugandan relations or the beginning of a movement in Africa?
I think it's both. This has been ongoing, and particularly what's of interest is that in many ways, the United States is exporting its own cultural wars to Africa. And I say that insofar as the evangelicals in this country have been going to Uganda, holding big rallies, talking about equating pedophilia with homosexuality, as well as putting up gay porno and making it seem as if that is what, in fact, same-sex relationships are, which, of course, it is not. And so you have evangelicals on the one hand preaching an anti-homosexuality message and getting a big, finding good ground in the conservative nature of society across Africa and in Uganda in particular. And then you have the American administration trying to make cultural issues a basis for foreign policy and trying to use a leverage of foreign aid to force governments, in fact, to go against their own public sentiment, even though they're supposed to be democracies. And so really these countries are being caught between the dynamics of our own unsettled sort of cultural, social progression of this country. And I think it's very unfortunate that it becomes a complication and U.S. relations, as also creates a backlash within these societies, which is heightened homophobia across Africa.
Now, the irony there is that you would actually agree that there is something like social imperialism going on. You just think it's the evangelicals who are responsible for it, not the gay community in the United States or the West.
No, I actually think it's both. I think it's both the evangelicals and the gays in the United States and the West who are playing out their own struggle across Africa. I think that this is really fundamentally an issue of human rights. And I think that human rights are best advanced by domestic constituencies within countries and that those countries make progression based on their domestic struggles, just like it has been done here. So I think that obviously, whether a person is gay or straight, they have a right to be protected under the law. And so it's very unfortunate that you have these anti-gay laws taking place in Africa. But I definitely think it's a manifestation of the exportation of our own cultural battles, both on the side of the U.S. administration, gay rights groups, and evangelicals fighting out their battles overseas.
So you tend to think that the Obama administration could inflame the situation by withholding foreign aid.
Well, it has already. And quite frankly, it doesn't even make sense to put foreign aid as an issue because 95% of the foreign aid that the United States provides to Uganda goes towards helping people with HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria. It's all towards health. And so the idea that you're going to cut the assistance for addressing HIV and AIDS because of anti-homosexual laws is really very counterproductive. The other aid goes to our own interests of fighting terrorism in places like Somalia, with Uganda is carrying the burden for us on that, and towards democracy, human rights, and governance programs. And so our foreign assistance, one, is not very much of Uganda's economy.
And Jindai Fraser, former U.S. Secretary of State for African Affairs, we'll leave it there. She's also a distinguished public service professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
here's a reality moment we dream of on Oscar night.
And the Oscar for Best Picture goes to Dallas Buyers Club. Here to accept the award is William Wayborn.
I want to thank a lot of people who died making this movie. I mean, there were so many people who are not alive today that would love to see this kind of a movie being made. I lost all of our friends in that time frame. For some people, it was just bad luck, and for others, it's a tragedy.
William Wayborn will not be accepting an Oscar for Dallas Buyers Club this year, but he's still rooting for the film because he lived the real story that the movie is based on back in the 1980s when he was president of the Dallas Gay Alliance, and Ron Woodruff, the main character in Dallas Buyers Club, was a volunteer there and received services through the center's AIDS clinic. All this week, Oscar-nominated films and the real stories behind them told by some of the folks who definitely weren't actors when they lived this history. From Real People, Best Pictures. That's what we're calling this series.
They got good meds out of Mexico. That's better than what you can get here in the States.
This is protein, totally non-toxic.
And you can't buy this in the USA?
Unproved.
You could be making a fortune off of this.
That's Matthew McConaughey playing Ron Woodruff in Dallas Buyers Club, all about a drug-selling scam to get critical medicine to AIDS patients. William Wayborn knew Ron Woodruff well and certainly remembers those days.
There were buyers clubs all over the country. At those times, we did what we could to bring in drugs because a lot of drugs were considered experimental. And while they were readily available overseas, they weren't available in the United States or were considered illegal. So what Ron did is he sort of monetized it to be able to make money off of it. And no one begrudged him of that. But the Dallas Buyers Club was really just one of many clubs around the country. We also imported drugs through our own clinic by using flight attendants to bring in new experimental drugs that were already in use overseas but still illegal in the U.S.
So Ron is this entrepreneur, Ron Woodruff, played by Matthew McConaughey, is this entrepreneur, homophobe, chauvinistic, kind of a racist cowboy who puts it all together. Is that how you understood Ron Woodruff?
Well, certainly not for the period of time that I knew Ron. Ron worked in our center, which was a gay center. It was run by gay people. He was a patient of our clinic, which was a gay clinic. Now, true, there weren't a lot of other places to go for treatments, but he was very much immersed into the gay life, into Dallas at that time. And, at that time, people passed for straight for lots of different reasons. And this movie is taken from an interview with Ron in the morning news. And the irony of it is that people, were not going to come out in the Dallas Morning News in the 80s. So I think that what they've done is now they sort of twisted the character to fit a stereotype. And unfortunately, I think it does not serve the purpose well. They really didn't have to create this character. He was a very compelling person. There's no question about it. But he was also very, very sick. You don't go out and ride bulls when you're that sick. And so, he did a lot of things, but there were a lot of people in the same situation who were doing that. Fortunately, Ron got this interview in the paper, and that's what the basis for the movie is. But again, I think that they've tried to twist him into something that he really wasn't.
Is part of your point here that Hollywood, even today, needs a hero in portraying the AIDS crisis, and that from your perspective, we really should be past that, that we don't need to clean up or heroize the victims and the people who suffered so greatly when this scourge was at its peak?
Absolutely. The movie is not a bad movie, but it really only focuses on this individual and what was going on in, Dallas at that time. But it's really not a very accurate portrayal of the times. We had four or five funerals a week. You didn't go out and party. You went home and learned how to hank IV poles. It wasn't a pleasant time. And unfortunately, I think the movie sort of glosses over that so that they could create this hero and make him into something that, he was a renegade, and he certainly brought drugs into the U.S., but he wasn't the only one. There were a lot of people who were doing the same thing.
Nevertheless, do you think the movie does bring some positive attention to an experience that that most Americans might be completely unaware of?
Oh, absolutely. Most people under 40 don't even know there was an AIDS crisis, endemic of AIDS in the world. So it represents a time when people were really sick and that they died from a lot of opportunistic infections. And in the early days of AIDS and gay activism, we thought that any media portrayal was good because it forced people to talk about it. And I think that's what the movie does. It forces people to not only acknowledge that this existed, but to talk about it. And while it may be controversial, it still requires someone to talk to their kids about it at night.
And are you rooting for this movie to win an Oscar? It's nominated for 6.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's a good movie. And both McConaughey and Jared Leto deserve all kinds of recognition for their awards. And I hope that they recognize the individuals who they're portraying. But, you know, losing weight won't get you an Academy Award.
So what do you win if this movie does take home a lot of gold?
I think we all get to talk about the movie. And that's a very important process. As long as we can continue to talk about AIDS and gays, I think that, you know, the world has to recognize that this is a problem still and that individuals are still suffering because of it.
William Wayborn was the president of the Dallas Gay Alliance in the 1980s, which served the gay community and people living with AIDS. Ron Woodruff was a volunteer there. He received services through the center's clinic. And Ron Woodruff, of course, is the central character in the movie Dallas Buyers Club. William, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow and Thursday, we'll be talking to the real people behind the movies American Hustle and 12 Years a Slave. Clayton Adams, great-great-great-grandson of Solomon Northup, joins us later this week in our series From Real People, Best Pictures.
Having Solomon Northup's story, which was left out of American history, not just African-American history, but American history for going on 200 years now, I mean, that in itself is pride enough that his story is finally being told worldwide. It's already been bigger than any statue.
And if you buy the premise that from real people come the best pictures, what story in your life makes an Oscar-winning movie? Share it at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us online at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Earlier this hour, we spoke about the overall mission of college fraternities and the experience of joining such a group. Lots of stories from you, including some disturbing stories of sexual abuse and rape cases on campus associated with fraternities. Here's a comment from one of you in Portland, Oregon. Two fraternities were involved in reckless and dangerous initiations, as well as parties which ended with multiple people in the hospital with severe alcohol poisoning. The fraternities had their charters suspended. On Facebook, Patrick says, I don't like it when the Greek system gets scapegoated just because they are one of the only social groups on campus easy to point the finger at. Greeks do far more volunteer work and philanthropy. But is there a risk of having a child join a fraternity in college? Insurance companies seem to think so. One of the largest components of fraternity dues in 2014 goes to pay insurance premiums. And even that insurance is limited. Way beyond traditional pledge week hazing, there is a lot of risky behavior at fraternities that not even insurance companies will cover, and many students and parents discover this long after something bad has happened. Caitlin Flanagan is a contributing editor at The Atlantic who spent a year looking at this issue.
You know, the first thing people who are kind of new to this problem or who haven't learned sort of in depth about it will say is, if frat row is so bad, why don't the colleges just eliminate the fraternities? And in fact, colleges have tremendous amount of interdependence on these fraternities. One in eight students in America who goes to college lives in Greek housing. So that's a huge amount of housing colleges don't have to pay for, maintain. And also fraternity men are excellent givers to their colleges and universities. And if you irritate fraternity men, if you shut down a chapter, those fraternity men will react immediately and transfer all their annual giving to the fraternity and away from the host institution. So the colleges have more to lose by unaffiliating with the fraternities than the fraternities have to lose by ending a relationship with the college.
You also describe an incentive, almost a psychological incentive, Fraternities serve a purpose of providing an argument that college is actually a blast. How does that work, do you think?
The great majority of our thousands and thousands of American undergraduates are going to huge public universities and obscure private colleges that are desperate for students. They can't stay open if they don't have them. So what ends up happening is you take a young man who's been kind of lackluster in high school and you say, okay, son, you have two choices. You can go work a really hard minimum wage job and live at home with mom hassling you all the time, or you can go to college and join a fraternity and pump the keg. Which do you think he's going to choose? And many, many times, 40% of the time, he doesn't even graduate. 60% of them end up with loans that they carry to their deathbed. You know, maybe mom and dad should have sent him to Club Med for a week, and he could have had that fun and paid it off a lot more quickly.
All this is by way of saying that parents and students go into the fraternity experience blind to the liabilities, and that really forms the core of your investigation here. Way beyond hazing, what sorts of reckless kinds of things can happen in a fraternity, and what recourse do students and parents have when these tragedies occur?
Well, you know, probably the most surprising thing to me, we have a lot of internal documents from the fraternities. One of them is a chart about injury incidents at fraternities produced by the fraternity industry, by their insurance carriers. I always would say, oh, the most dangerous thing is hazing. Hazing is the least common insurance claim against fraternities. Number one, assault and battery. They get really drunk and they fight and they get injured. Number two is sexual assault. 15% of all insurance claims against fraternities are by young women claiming sexual assault within the fraternity houses. And then number three and four, tied very closely, are these horrendous falls. They just get so liquored up and they're forever trying to climb up the fire escape or taking a serious head dive off a balcony. And kids get traumatically injured on a fairly regular basis in these drunken falls.
And then the parents become plaintiffs. And here's one, Gary Bogenberger, who's the father of a fatality at Northern Illinois University.
These young men should have been aware of the dangers of forcing even a 200-pound young man to consume 40 ounces of vodka in a two-hour period. They ignored it. And when they started passing out, they discussed calling 911 and decided not to because that would make their actions more public, and they thought they'd just put them all to bed and walk away from the thing.
And of course, Gary's 19-year-old son David was eventually found dead at the Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity back in 2012. And what this parent discovered, and what a lot of parents maybe don't know, is that in many ways they've signed away the fraternity's liability for events like this by consuming even a modest amount of alcohol, and that liability suddenly shifts to the parents. How does that work in insurance terms?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two parts to that story, and I just say very quickly, that moment when he said they thought about calling 911 and they didn't, that's just what happened if you know the kid died in the Baruch College hazing incident in Pennsylvania. Police just revealed that as the kid was dying, his fraternity brothers were Googling head injuries. They didn't want to call 911. Why? Because they know that the insurance liability that comes up around issues of hazing will leave all of them in the lurch, and so a lot of times they won't call 911. When fraternity industry says to a kid is, come on in, we have fraternity insurance. The biggest part of the dues you'll pay are for your insurance. And mom and dad are far away, and they think, well, I hope nothing bad happens to my son, but I know if he ever gets caught up in one of these crazy lawsuits, we won't be liable. Not true. The fraternity will say, oh, you were part of it. You didn't haze that kid, but you were there that night. You knew it was going on. Therefore, you're cut off from your fraternity insurance, and you're no longer part of the fraternity. And where is the plaintiff going to recover those damages? From mom and dad's homeowner's insurance. And so the amount of financial liability that you add as a planning for retirement parent when your son joins a fraternity is probably the number one thing I'd like parents to take away from this essay.
Why doesn't this financial cost, why doesn't it constrain the fraternities to enforce a better code of behavior?
Well, the deepest value of fraternity life going back to the 19th century and even in a sense to the 18th century from the sort of Freemasonry that it grew out of, this notion of independence. The whole point of the fraternity life was to be independent of colleges and the kind of ministers who used to run colleges in the 19th century, and that you weren't going to be answerable to any other body except to one another and to the laws of the land. And what senior fraternity people will tell you, and a lot of them are very respectable men, they'll say there's a huge problem in American college campuses, which is you're getting all these kids whose entire high school experience has consisted of mom and dad bailing them out of any problem they ever got in. And a lot of kids show up at college thinking, rules don't apply to me. Well, it really does. They just don't have mom and dad there anymore to protect them from themselves.
Or mom and dad are understanding that it's a whole different world now, and you can't simply recover from some of these events that take place in fraternities. Caitlin Flanagan, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
Caitlin Flanagan is contributing editor at The Atlantic magazine. Her piece is in the current issue, all about her year-long investigation into the culture and consequences of fraternity life in America. Speaking of fraternity culture, a lot of real life went into the making of the classic movie Animal House.
Toga, 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 toga.
The brilliant Harold Ramis was one of the writers of Animal House. He died on Monday. His comedies, written, directed, or produced, have helped define an era. Ghostbusters, Caddyshack, Groundhog Day, Analyze This. President Obama today called him one of America's greatest satirists, who made you laugh until it hurt and then question authority. Ramis put a lot of his own nerdy life on screen. Tell us about the story in your life that would make an Oscar-worthy film. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.